Family Reunion by Maxine Kuman. The week in August you come home, adult, professional, aloof, we roast and carve the fatted calf, in our case, homegrown pig, the chine garlicked and crisped, the applesauce hand-pressed, hand-pressed the greengage wine. Nothing is cost-effective here. The peas, the beets, the lettuces, hand-sown, are raised to stand apart. The electric fence ticks like the slow heart of something we fed and bedded for a year, then killed with kindness's one bullet and paid Jake Mott to do the butchering. In winter we lure the birds with suet, thaw lungs and kidneys for the cat. Darlings, it's all a circle from the ring of wire that keeps the raccoons from the corn to the gouged pine table that we lounge around, distressed before any of you were born. Benign and dozy from our gluttonies, the candles down to stubs, defenses down, love leaking out unguarded, the way juice dribbles from the fence when grounded by grass stalks or a forgotten hoe. How eloquent, how beautiful you seem. Wearing our gestures, how wise you grow, ballooning to overfill our space, the almost parents of your parents now. So briefly having you back to measure us is harder than having let you go. Family Reunion by Maxine Kuman, from the collection Our Ground Time Here Will Be Brief, Viking Press, 1989. As the lilacs fade and the peonies droop, the mailbox begins to fill with cheery requests and reminders that annual reunion plans are being made. Sometimes family, sometimes school, sometimes church or other affiliations. These days, when practically everyone has an email address, the requests are sometimes followed by cheery email reminders. And then comes the uncomfortable moment. Shall we simply toss the snail mail request into the round file, press delete? Or is there perhaps one person from our distant past about whom we really wonder? And is finding that one person again perhaps worth the inevitable discomfort inherent in trying too hard to recreate days that are much better in retrospect than they can ever be again? Today, the Mind's Eye Radio Collective ponders these and other questions in reunions, or once a year is more than enough. John Morgan recalls the perils of expectation about attending the more common kind of meetup, a high school reunion.
For years, I had passed on invitations to attend the class reunion of my high school, Dogwood High in Apple Falls, Iowa. But after turning 65, I thought I might as well go back and catch up on some of my old classmates after 47 years. There were only three people I really wanted to see: John Pocious, Fred Morgan, and Betty McGraw. John and Fred were the two funniest guys in school, but they weren't class clowns. Their humor was subtle and understated. They both had a knack for being spontaneously funny, a quality I lacked, although I emulated them in my own way. I could only be funny in writing, which caused me to wonder why neither of them seemed interested in using their gift in that way. Oddly enough, they didn't seem to know each other. They moved in different circles. John played the baritone in our school band. He was the only person in the band who could play a tune by ear. In the 10th grade, he married Lola, who was a grade ahead of him. Lola got what she wanted, but John got too far ahead of himself. That marriage lasted a year, which everyone predicted. Fred lived out on a farm somewhere with a few horses on it. He had figured out a way to avoid the draft. He kept failing the 11th grade for 8 years in a row. When he was in my class, he was 23. He told me he had read every book in the school library, but he didn't care about grade, so he just kept making Fs. He was able to get away with that because they made him the janitor's assistant. Sometimes you'd see him walking around with an armload of books, and sometimes you'd see him walking around with a ladder. I still consider him the most sane person I've ever known. His only friends were the misfits and the mildly retarded. They tagged around with him, and he made them laugh, while dispensing useful advice, like telling one kid not to run away from home, but stay there and help his parents solve their problems. Although Fred was accidentally funny, by nature he was a philosopher. Once our English teacher had us taking turns reading in class from Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage. About the second week, Mrs. Campbell called on Fred to read. "What are you reading?" he asked. She told him. He nonchalantly replied, "Oh, I finished that book last week. I'm reading a new one now." Once he got sent to the principal's office for deliberately mangling the preamble to the Constitution, we were all roaring with laughter. Mr. Smith didn't think it was so funny. And there was a time we were all filing out of class when I heard him say to no one in particular, "I feel so unnecessary." It was a few years later before I realized that Fred was an existentialist. He probably didn't even know it himself. There were no philosophy books in our library. When I got out of the army, I asked my brother what became of Fred. He said the last he heard, he had joined the army. I also asked him what became of Betty McGraw. He said she had gone to New York to be an actress, but hadn't made it. So she came back to Apple Falls. I was surprised to learn that she had gone to New York. I was even more surprised to learn that she hadn't succeeded. When Betty was in my English class, whenever she read aloud, she read so naturally, so beautifully, giving every voice in the dialogue its own expression, its own accent. I never had an erotic fantasy about her because she lived in a faster lane than I did. But when she read aloud, I couldn't help imagining what it would be like to be married to her and listen to her read to our children in that rich, melodious voice. That was the kind of woman I wanted to marry. I assumed she was aware of her gift and never mentioned it to her. Until a couple of years after we graduated, I was sitting in the library downtown when she hesitantly walked up to me. "John, is that you?" It took me a few seconds to recognize her, too. She had changed in 2 years. We talked for a few minutes. It was then that I told her how much I used to love to listen to her read, and that it had always been plain to me that she was a born actress. I was stunned when she told me she had never thought of that. She told me where she worked and told me if I came to see her sometime, she could take a coffee break. I did that once, and she sat down at a table full of people, deliberately foiling my plan to ask her out. But I still don't understand how she didn't make it in New York. I didn't get to ask her because she wasn't at the reunion, and neither was Fred, of course, because that wasn't his sort of thing, and neither was John. There were a couple of old people there, and I didn't know who any of them were. None of them remembered me, either. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
If we bother to attend reunions at all, we may want to really share our true selves with our former associates. But that way is not for the faint of heart, as Evie Thompson relates.
I regularly return to the reunions of the high school class I would have been in had we not moved after my freshman year. I feel they are still my class, since I started kindergarten with many of them. Class reunions bring out some tough feelings, especially as you get older and your dreams haven't come true, or you've put on weight, or you're seeing again someone who has caused you a great deal of pain. There were 72 who graduated in that class, but not all of them come. At the party before this last reunion, which celebrated 50 years since graduation, some 30 of us got together for beer and brats at one classmate's home in the woods. One of the men who lived in the town but had not attended any of the reunions was there. He was a successful businessman and had been well-liked in high school, but still had not wanted to come. He said to those of us standing near, "If I'd known how much fun these things are, I would have come years ago." Reunions do change over time. At the earlier ones, people can be competitive, materialistic, and sometimes downright unkind. I felt this improved greatly as time passed, so that the 50th anniversary of our high school graduation was, on the whole, a real pleasure. For example, I remember an early reunion where everyone was crowing about a classmate who had founded a major national burger chain. It was as if they were saying, "Look, one of us really made it, and that makes our whole class special." Another example of an early reunion. By the 20-year reunion, my goals had shifted radically. I'd given up being an artist and hoping to be America's response to Picasso, and had 9 years of motherhood under my belt. And I was enjoying it. Baking, sewing, sometimes canning, reading bedtime stories, carving pumpkins. I even sewed the dress I wore to the reunion. And while it wasn't haute couture, I was proud of it. A male classmate came up to me and said, "Don't feel bad that you didn't make much of a success of your life." That took me aback. Is it possible he was really trying to make me feel better? At another reunion, I noticed a woman classmate in an intense discussion with one of the guys. Afterwards, I mentioned this to her and I said, "What were you two talking about?" She said, "Oh, the R word." "Reminiscing?" I ventured. "No, recriminations," she said, wrinkling her face. "We went together for a while." The strange pain and pleasure of reunions extends even to the landscape. The town and surrounding countryside have a powerful pull. The year after my sister Nancy died, at the next reunion, I returned to my hometown and saw that the elementary school we'd attended had been pulled down and replaced. The original school was a prim, square, two-story building with 8 classrooms set high so that light would come in through the basement windows. The new building is low to the ground, sleek and cozy-looking. Automatically, I thought, I must tell Nancy about this. And then I realized, but she's not here anymore. Before the reunion marking the 50th year after graduation, I got into some soul-searching again. What had I done with my life? And had I missed the boat? I had lost 40 pounds and then put 10 back on, and oh, how I longed to have them off again. At the reunion itself, we met, some 60 altogether with spouses, at long tables in one of those northern Wisconsin dining halls adjacent to a dark bar. While the graduating class had been 72, our ranks had thinned. A memorial in the program honored 18 of us who had died. I was saddened by those deaths. Some of those folks I'd known from early childhood. There were also 2 classmates who could not be traced. We were mostly grandparents and great-grandparents in the midst of retirement, a lot of gray hair and some floppy skin and wrinkles, but on the whole still trying to look our best and grateful just to have made it this far in life. Across the table from me sat a pair that I scarcely knew. He'd been in the class but was one of the students who rode the school bus in from the farm and so had been unable to engage in a lot of the after-school activities. As an adult, he had his own farm and had become a musician with a small polka band. His wife worked on the farm, milking 5 cows by hand. No milking machine here. She had names for each of her cows, and she talked about them the way the rest of us talk about our children, their unique behaviors and characters, and with great fondness. After the meal, the MC asked each classmate to stand and briefly tell what we were doing with our lives. As most spoke of their children and their families, and a few spoke of hobbies, I thought about what I would say. We had been deeply involved with the mental health community where we live in Madison, Wisconsin. Our younger daughter suffers with mental illness, and we have, at times, spent many hours with her. She has some of the worst symptoms I've seen or heard of. These have gotten markedly better with medication and therapy. As for our activities, my husband co-facilitated a support group for other parents who have adult children with mental illness. There were other activities there, too, at the local chapter of the National Association for Mental Illness that we both engaged in. If I got up and spoke of this, what would they think of me? So much of the last century, bad child rearing was blamed for mental illness, and it was seen especially as the mother's fault. Only recently has science begun to catch up, with brain scans and studies to show that this is a disease just like diabetes, with physical causes. About individuals with mental illness, people often think, "I am not one of them." The stigma is almost instantaneous. I knew that if I spoke about our daughter, the stigma would also attach to me, and yet this had been the center of my life for some time. I did manage to do it. I spoke about our daughter, and it was painful. It left me feeling one down and with a bruised ego. As soon as the program was over, I fled. I scarcely spoke to a friendly classmate who tried to waylay me at the door with some conversation. So why do we go to class reunions if it can be so painful? There is something iconic there, maybe even biological, like a salmon swimming upstream to spawn. We're having another class reunion this next summer, and what I have discovered is that I do very much care for many of these folks and want to know that their lives are going well. So, in spite of everything, or maybe because of it, I'll go, and I am looking forward to it. This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Someone once quipped that she realized as she grew older just how much her parents had learned over the years. Most of us seem to come of age before we come to wisdom, but some of us have the grace to recall that experience cannot be foisted upon the young. As a parent, Guy Thorvaldsen watches and reflects and bites his tongue as he recognizes himself in his maturing daughter.
Lately, it's become clear to me why, when I was a newly minted teenager, my parents didn't talk much to me, despite all the questions I had cooking about the world. Before coming a teen, their message to me was to be seen and not heard, but as 13 rolled around, the message became all-inclusive, not seen and not heard. I used to think it was simply that they disagreed with my choice to wear torn and patched jeans or beaded necklaces and headbands, or listen to loud bands who were thankful to be dead. Or perhaps it was that most conversations with my dad ended up in a verbal boxing match. In this corner, hailing from the Dwight Eisenhower School of Capitalism, Dad, the capitalist. And in the far corner, hailing from the Mao Tse-sung brand of socialism, the son. But now I am in the dad corner, squaring off with an equally passionate 13-year-old, and I'm seeing things a bit differently, that my parents' desire to not engage with me was understandable. No, it's not about the daily aggravation brewed by the fact that my daughter begins and ends most sentences with, "I know," or with an exasperated, "Dad!" The real challenge is that with each mini-drama or trauma my daughter goes through, I enter an emotional time machine. hurled back into memories of my own teen angst and struggles. It's like going to a perpetual class reunion, the classic kind where nothing has changed, and Bobby Jones is still asking me, how's it hanging? But it's worse than that. Here's how it goes. I'm going along my merry adult way, perhaps thinking I might be at least slightly above it all. And then I catch my daughter emailing an older high school boy into the wee hours of a school night. I open my mouth, attempt to come up with something both loving and stern. But suddenly I remember how it was to be 14 again. I re-experience the excruciating confusion of this raging desire to have sex, yet having no idea where to begin, and if I do, wondering if I'll be smote by God or my parents, or worse yet, ridiculed by the offended girl. But now my daughter awaits, rolling her eyes. I am the dad with the scarred up heart, who is above nothing, but hopefully knows something. And this is the ongoing reunion of what it is to be human. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
I can't get this baby to sleep. I've tried everything I know. I wish my dad were here.
Have you ever been in a difficult situation and just wanted a little fatherly advice? Well, Ron Cotell proudly announces the new Digital Audio Dad.
Oh, hey, wait. I've got my DAD right here.
This is your dad. Please state the crisis.
DAD, Jessica is driving me crazy. What's that bedtime story you used to tell me?
Don't panic, honey. Just hold me close to Jessica's ear. Once upon a time, there was an Easter egg named Fred who got lost in a shoe.
Yes, folks, a universe of advice and guidance at your fingertips, and a virtual shoulder to lean on when times get tough. All for the incredibly low price of just $19.99. Act now and get a DAD advice for the ages absolutely free. It contains such timeless classics as...
Son, you have to be the man of the family while I'm gone.
And... Young lady, I expect you to be home by 11 p.m. and not a minute later, or you'll be grounded for life! As you've heard, our amazing Digital Audio Dad comes in a variety of styles and accents, each so realistic you'll swear you're talking to the real thing. This is your dad.
Oh, thank God, Digital Audio Dad. I just got a flat and I'm stuck here in the middle of nowhere. What should I do?
What are you doing driving alone on a deserted highway? You know how dangerous that is. You aren't going to visit that rock musician, are you? You know I don't approve of him. Oi, how I hate that. That's Digital Audio Dad, available now in all fine electronics stores. Get yours today.
Paul Thompson takes the very long view of reunification of family in The Klein Reunion.
Klein women sit in the shade and keep a watchful eye on tots. The cousins shout at volleyball. Bob barbecues the brats. From the ice-filled tub, Freddy fishes out a beer. Already his ruddy face is glowing. He's getting drunk again this year. Car doors slam. Cousin Mary and her husband, Harry Scholes, bear a bowl of baked beans to join the salads and casseroles. Grandpa Otto, 94, roomy of eye, mottled of skin, his mind increasingly in question, raises his father's violin and shapes the blue skirt waltz with halting, forgetful hands, only a faded echo of 20s, barn dances, and polka bands. But more than loud and gay enough, to wake long-sleeping kin, dark and deep within the earth, Klein bones stir again. Shoemaker Samuel, who cut and stitched boots for Washington's men, Betty, who died at 8 of worms, Jacob the preacher, obsessed with sin. Paul, fresh from the furrow, pierced at Bull Run by a rebel round. Sally, who modeled in New York, all unsettled by the sound. Frail femurs would frolic again, staring skulls would like to sing, guzzle beer, gulp brats, gossip with the living. Each skeleton murmurs to the other and stirs and tries to leave its rest, but cannot rise. Dirt lies too heavily on its chest. It's no use, Sally whispers. We will never see the sun. Let us wait until they come to our reunion. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Being human and heir to all the little vanities and insecurities we secretly harbor, we may approach school class reunions at any level with equal measure of excitement and trepidation. Who has changed the most? Who looks basically the same? And how did she pull that off? We wonder, and Esther Cameron screws up her courage, attends, and then is left wondering about those who could not make the leap.
This poem is a rondeau, which is a French form that turns on a single phrase that is repeated three times. In this case, we meet again. I thought it would be appropriate for the theme of a class reunion. We meet again after a lapse of years, our ancient rivals and our erstwhile dears. The mind retrieves with effort names and faces, and sometimes needs to excavate time's traces before the youthful countenance appears. Some wear the air of those who've had successes, while others far less confident look confesses. With all that's been fulfilled of hopes and fears, we meet again. But what of those who did not come? One hears sad things. The conversation quickly veers from deaths, and only nibbles at disgraces. Don't go there, signs are posted many places. More will be told when out beyond the spheres we meet again. Till the re-seeing, I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
Amidst all the sad and extreme divisiveness threatening our nation before the last presidential election, some heard Barack Obama's message of hope and change as a promise to reunite a nation at internal war. Judith Zuckerman wonders whether the union will ever really fulfill the promise of reunion between the promises and the present facts.
When is the reunion? Where is the man who inspired us when he raised our hopes high, campaigning for the presidency? Where is the voice who spoke of single-payer health care when his presidency was an unspoken dream? How can Obama give our sweated-for tax dollars to fat cat bankers and Wall Street hotshots, raking in bonuses while millions go unemployed or skimp living on reduced hours and furlough days? How will the voices of we ordinary folks be heard in Congress over the din of lobbyists who pour money into pockets of our so-called representatives? Who will pay attention to people losing jobs, homes, flooding food pantries, families living in cars and shelters, struggling to survive? Who could imagine 2 out of 3 children needing free and reduced price lunches in such a rich nation? Why do our leaders choose to pay for two wars instead of putting the unemployed to work, bolstering crumbling bridges, obsolete pipes, sewers, and schools? Why does a whistleblower who dares to tell the truth go to jail, not those he exposes, who hide fortunes for taxes in other lands? What can we Wisconsinites say about justice when 6% of us are African Americans, yet they are 48% of those locked in our prisons? When will we have a reunion of the ideals of democracy and the reality on the ground? This is Judith Zuckerman for Mind's Eye Radio.
Who hasn't marveled at the sight of these wide loads lumbering down the highways, accompanied by a circus's worth of flashing warnings and flags? Like turtles, these flatbeds are carrying houses on their backs. Fran Rawls' active imagination leads her to speculate about their finding their other halves.
Highway life. The half houses rolled briskly down the highway, carefully shrouded with opaque covering. They are looking for their other half. The bathroom can't find the bedrooms. The kitchen has no one to cook for. Who lives in these houses? Shadow shapes, paper doll thin, who lean against the walls and built-in furniture. Or half figures moving in strange one-legged hip-hops. What do they eat? Unpopped popcorn, half a grapefruit, half a loaf, half and half, and they drink weak coffee so pale you can see the rose in the bottom of the cup. This is Fran Rawl moving along life's highway for Mind's Eye Radio.
It's probably a safe generalization to say that most of us lead fairly predictable lives after our formative years. Statistically, most marry and have children, hold rather unglamorous jobs, form alliances, pay taxes. If not living lives of quiet desperation, as Thoreau famously said, we at least lead lives of quiet quietness. Some, like Louise Mancuso, choose more unusual courses, but still wonder what might have become of their young companions.
For most of 2006, I had been thinking about whether or not there might be a class of 1957 Bishop Quigley High School 50th reunion sometime next year. I was hoping there would be. I wanted to know what happened to everyone, especially since there were less than 50 of us. Pearl didn't graduate, didn't get a yearbook, even though her graduation picture is in it. After we got the book, I went to show her, like she asked. She wanted one so bad. I was tempted to give her mine, but I knew my family didn't have the money to pay for another one, and she didn't have the money. Plus, I didn't even know if there was an extra one available, because Pearl didn't have enough credits to graduate and had left school just weeks before. The nuns only ordered one for each of the girls who were graduating. No, I wanted to keep mine. I already had notes that friends scribbled onto the inside front and back covers, as well as under the senior photos. I couldn't give away the book where Carol MacDonald, who I skipped school with once, inscribed, "Lou, I'm not going to say the same old thing. How about, I hope your veins keep all their blood for good health. Luck forever, Mac, my real nickname." Sister Mary Mora, who had charge of the yearbook, had put Carol in her nickname space, even though we all called her Mac. Yep, she was out of it like most of the nuns, except for Sister Mary Antoinette, who had joined the sisters who taught us late in life when she was in her 30s, rather than teens or 20s, as was the norm in the 1950s. She even had a glass of wine to drink at our 10th class reunion, which was something we thought nuns never did. The 10th was the only reunion I knew of and had attended, purchasing a generic basic black cocktail dress for the occasion, a version of which I was assured everyone else would be showing up in. I didn't know much about those things, having been in the cloister for 7 years and out in the world again for only 3. And I want to know what happened to Connie, a tiny Italian like myself, who, according to classmates.com, married an Italian fellow, probably, I'm figuring, from the west side of Buffalo, like herself. She didn't have a boyfriend while we were in school. In fact, most of us didn't. Except for Charlotte, who was 3 years older than the rest of us. She had the same boyfriend all through high school, and they were going to get married right after graduation. Char told us how they were saving their money, were going to buy a ranch and have lots of children and animals. And we knew that was just what they would do. That same website has Char listed with it under her married name, and I'm betting that's the same fellow she's been with all this time. At the senior class picnic, Char turned up in her boyfriend's beat-up black convertible with a hole in the floor and drove onto the grassy picnic grounds at Chestnut Ridge with it, beeping for us to hop in so we could ride around while our teachers tended the hot dogs and hamburgers they had placed on the grill for lunch. And I'm wondering what happened to Barb, who I know married the fellow she went to the prom with, and was from the same neighborhood where she and Margie, Yazzie, and Bogey grew up. My best friend Alice, who was also in that group and kept me up to date on things, continued to write me letters after I entered the monastery, but stopped after not hearing back from me for long periods of time. My letters had been censored going out and coming in, and when I asked about not hearing from her, I was told that my mind was not to be filled with distracting news of the world, but instead must focus on meditation and prayer to fulfill the life of a contemplative. That part was hard, and the early risings and going to bed, and not having a person with whom to share my affection. That was probably the hardest. But how did they fare, all those who married and had mates and children to love? Were they satisfied with their lives? Did they prove to be all that they had hoped? What would the group of us share of the stories of our lives if we were to get together again after all these years? 2007 came and went. No 50th reunion. Just as well. It was difficult enough as part of that group, dealing with being a 17-year-old. This is Louise Mancuso for Mind's Eye Radio.
Simon and Garfunkel sang of the mother and child reunion and made it sound like something we should all seek. But the way back to relatives from whom one is estranged is tricky at best. Bridget Birdsall managed it, but only by reawakening what she terms Irish black humor.
Recently, I connected with my sister, whom I've not spoken with in many years. Though we live thousands of miles apart, we soon found ourselves laughing, despite tears. In that magical moment when I heard my sister's laughter coming through the line, gratitude filled my heart, for it could only be some kind of God-given gift that enabled us, after all this time, not only to reconnect, but through shared laughter, to forgive, to heal, and to transcend the tragedies of our past. Together, we waxed nostalgically about a time in high school when, in an attempt to cheer her up, I jumped up onto my bed, flailing my arms and gyrating wildly in a perfect imitation of the Go-Go Girls on Soul Train. This memory alone brought on gales of laughter. It reminded me of those times when we'd laugh so hard that one of us would have to beg the other to stop. Today, I realize that our silly antics provided a distraction from the harsh realities of growing up in a home ravaged by violence, mental illness, and addiction. Yet it wasn't until well into adulthood that I began to understand the nuances of what we Irish call black humor. Humor not everyone finds funny. Humor that delicately traverses the razor's edge between joy and despair. I remember one cold winter night when we were in high school. We'd put our brothers to bed, and we sat huddled beneath a blanket watching Saturday Night Live. The late John Belushi, considered one of the great comic geniuses of all time, stood alone on the stage with a plastic doll lying in a crib. My sister stuck her fingers in her ears to block the urgent and primal sound of a crying child. I sank deep down into the blanket, frozen, mesmerized, wishing it would stop. On the stage, Belushi's eyebrows danced up and down. Laughter rippled through the crowd. My sister and I began to giggle as Belushi attempted to calm the pretend child. But predictably, his soothing words were ineffective. The crying grew louder. Finally, when it became unbearable, he picked the doll up and whacked its head against the crib rail. Instantly, the crying stopped. My breath caught in my throat. A few nervous laughs erupted on the television. Belushi gently laid the doll back down. Relieved, my sister dropped her hands. Belushi slowly turned and tried to tiptoe away, but before he could sneak off, the crying resumed. And the further he moved away, the more the sound escalated in pitch and volume. The television crowd howled as he sank to his knees and clasped his hands in prayer. He pulled at his hair, rubbed his face, and waited. Gradually, the crying ceased. Once again, he stood up and tried to slip away. But this time, the sound rebounded with such ferocity that my fingers flew up to my ears. In a fury, Belushi grabbed the doll and began to rake its head back and forth against the crib rails, begging it to shut up. Just please shut up. The audience roared. My sister and I tried to stifle the strange impulse to laugh, but the harder we tried not to laugh, the more gasps of muffled laughter leaked out. Finally, my sister wiped away a tear. "Why are we laughing at this?" "It's sick," I whispered back, dabbing at my own eyes. Then I reached under the blanket and playfully pinched the underside of her arm, imitating our mother. "I'll give you something to cry about." She shrieked with laughter. "Oh my God, now that's really scary." In unison, we burst into uncontrolled hysteria and buried ourselves under the blanket so as not to disturb our mother, who had retired to the room above us with a jug of red wine. The scene switched to Dan Aykroyd saying, "Jane, you ignorant slut." To this day, I'm not sure what was funny about that scene. Perhaps because my sister and myself were both surrogate parents to our own rambunctious brothers. We knew firsthand how utterly powerless a person can feel when trying to calm a hysterical child. Moreover, for our own self-preservation, and to keep ourselves from having to witness a real baby suffer such a fate, we had spent the better part of our young adulthood vigilantly guarding against this very sound. A famous comic once said that all comedy is born of tragedy plus time. While this formula may be true, I have learned that not everyone shares the same taste when it comes to humor. When I read books such as Running with Scissors or The Glass House, I laugh aloud, while many of my friends never finish the book. Scientists say that when we laugh, certain calming chemicals are released in the brain, and this is why people who experience a great shock will sometimes break into fits of spontaneous laughter. This physiological response is the body's way of processing an event that the mind simply cannot wrap its arms around. This may explain why I sometimes find myself laughing when laughter is not really an appropriate response. A friend of mine recently told me that for thousands of years all across Asia, people have attended laugh camps where they sit around and laugh for hours in order to heal one another of illness and trauma. But the proof for me that laughter is the best medicine lives in my heart. Because when I heard my sister laughing, I knew beyond our bloodline, we shared something much more profound. We shared a well-honed, perverse ability to laugh, to see irony in the most excruciating pain and the most despicable of human behaviors. And this medicine, which had allowed us to cope with the pain of our past, continued to prove itself a powerful and potent healing agent. And when you think about it, there's really nothing funny about that. This is Bridget Birdsall signing off for Mind's Eye Radio.
We tend to think that once the chickadee has fledged, the bunny left the burrow, the dog trotted away, animals no longer recall their beginnings. Ruth Nichols and spouse Jim muse about what would happen if they, like we humans, decided to try reuniting. And if these creatures bear some resemblance to their human counterparts at your family's reunion, we might recall that allegory has a long and useful history.
By way of explanation, dear listeners, every 3 years, the descendants of 5 ancient rodents who once lived in or near a barn just outside Pattern, Nebraska, hold a reunion. In 2009, the reunion was held at YMCA Snow Mountain Ranch, west of Denver, Colorado. Estimated elevation, 8,700 feet. So now, for your pleasure, we present the Rodents Regular Ranch Rendezvous. On Thursday evening, the critters piled into the meeting room at the ranch. Excitement was high. All the adults were gabbing in groups. The littlest chipmunks were skittering back and forth at the front of the room. The young bats were teasing the squirrels, and the smallest marmots kept trying to dig through the pine floor. Patsy, a chipmunk, came to the front.
Okay, Chipper, Totter, Scamp, we need the stage now. You go scramble in the back of the room, please.
Betty Batling called Flitter and Hairpull back to their perches, where they joined Bertie and Bonnie, and the room grew quiet.
Now, just so we all know who everyone is, we're going to have everyone, every group, stand up and identify itself. Uncle Chester, you be first.
Aye, so I'll be first. I am Chester Harrison Chipmunk. Now, everyone in the Chipmunk clan, stand up and say your names.
I'm Bingo!
One at a time.
Then Martin Shoveler, the eldest of the marmots, spoke.
Chester, who is that? Just last week, you were telling me about your grandson, Nitta. Nitta, is your grandson Nitta here? Chester?
Yes, right over there next to Meep. Nitta, stand up next to Meep so your Uncle Martin can see you.
I am standing up. This went on for quite some time with the introduction of the rest of the rodent clans, the numerous marmots, the squirrels who had to be called down from the curtain rods, the bats who swept down from the ceiling, the prairie dogs who raised limp paws due to the high altitude, and the venerable persimmon pika, who had not missed a single rodent reunion but had never convinced any other member of her clan to come down from the mountain peaks. Before the recreational chair could begin to organize the next day's activities, Bonnie Batling pointed out that the bats' schedule of flights had already been made, and could they be excused to get at it? And before anyone could answer, all the bats escaped the room through the crack next to the chimney. Then Marcella Shoveler Marmot, the chair, came to the front.
First, I'd like to bring up Scramble Squirrel, who's planning us a stupendous scamper. Scram?
Thanks, Aunt Marcella. We have picked out 7 trees and...
Old Sheldon Squirrely stood up then.
Don't we get to stand up and say our names like the chipmunks did? Hey, Rosalia?
Grandpa, we already did that. Now hush, Scramble has the floor.
What's Scramble going to do with the floor? This modern stuff just doesn't make any sense. In my day, we stayed in the trees. We didn't sleep in bunks. And you can't bury an acorn in a floor.
Yes, like I said, we have picked out 7 trees that are all at least 700 years old and 700 feet tall. We'll meet at 6 tomorrow morning at the bottom of the first tree. We'll run to the top and then run back down. Then we'll run to the second tree, run to the top, and run back down. Then to the third tree, and run to the top, and so on, until we finish at the bottom of the 7th tree. That should take about 15 minutes. Then, if you want, we can run back to the first tree and start over. I've printed out some maps here that show where all the trees are.
Some of the teenagers looked unhappy at this. Nitpick moaned.
Twitchy and I think that's way too early. 6 a.m.? Aunt Marcella, don't you know teenagers have to sleep till noon?
Well, Picky, you kids could plan something for later in the afternoon. Just make sure you tell us when you're all going to start and where you'll be, so I can include it on our schedule.
Persimmon Pica murmured.
Aunt Marcella, so bossy. Next, she be telling us how many drops of water we can have in our drinking bowls.
And Dive Burrows said,
And hey, we marmots don't even climb trees. We're on the ground, man. We dig holes.
Old Sheldon Squirrely moaned.
And that sounds awfully strenuous. Especially for the elder squirrels like myself. And Swish and Screwy. 700-foot trees. We just don't have the energy you young squirrels do. Couldn't there be a more moderate tree scamper?
Well, okay, Grandpa. You wouldn't have to do all of the trees. Do only 3 of them, and only go halfway up. And you wouldn't have to come down right away.
Then Marianne Shoveler, Marcella Marmot's sister, spoke up. If you don't want to scramble, here's another idea. We have a team of 4 marmots who are going to dig a tunnel from the bunkhouse to the cafeteria, and we will take on anyone in a race. Remember how we did that at the last reunion, Martin?
Oh, well and good, Marianne. But you know I haven't done any actual digging for almost 2 years now. The clay just seems a lot harder than when I was young.
Harry Prairie Dog spoke in a quavery voice.
The Prairie Dogs and I would love to take you on, Marianne, but we don't feel too good at this altitude. Why does this meeting room have to be at the top of the hill anyway? I didn't think we'd be able to make it up here from the bunkhouse. Anyway... We are in the middle of building a new city, just west of Wichita. And we all have to leave tomorrow, right after breakfast.
Chipper Chipmunk jumped onto the stage and spun around.
Dig for nuts! We can dig for nuts!
At that point, the marmots gave up on their competition, deciding to keep the serious digging to themselves. More activities were mentioned, the nut chase favored by the young chipmunks and squirrels, the pine cone roast to be held before bedtime, And sometime on Saturday, a slide down the wire on the telephone cable that stretched from the ranch house to the big pole across the ravine.
Yee-haw!
Some of the chipmunks wanted to have a dance competition. The older rodents grumbled. Scurry Burrow Marmot complained.
We thought we might get to take a couple dog carts for a drive to the lake and stop at a meadow for a picnic in the sun. Climb trees? What idiots!
William Thump, a young prairie dog, complained to his parents.
But can't we dig a few holes with the marmots? I'm doing fine. I don't even need an inhaler.
By the end of the evening, the only ones who were happy were Betty, Bernie, Bonnie, Flitter, and Hairpole Bat, who hadn't had to stay through the meeting and were finding plenty of mosquitoes to munch on. And, of course, the elders of the Prairie Dog Clan, who were happy they could crawl downhill to the bunkhouse and finally get some sleep.
This is Jim Nichols.
This is Ruth Nichols.
This is Beam Ningaday.
And this is Kathy Miner.
For Mind's Eye Radio!
When the last brat's been consumed, the family photos distributed back to their owners, the children remarked upon, and the family recipes exchanged, we all retire with mixed emotions to our present wonderful, flawed, but everyday selves. Perhaps we are content, perhaps full of envy or resolve, but we're likely changed for better or for worse. Reunions have a way of doing that. We hope you're glad you attended ours. Mind's Eye attendees today were Bridget Birdsell, Esther Cameron, Louise Mancuso, John Morgan, Ruth and Jim Nichols, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rall, Paul Thompson, Evie Thompson, Guy Thurvoldsen, and Judith Zuckerman. Original music by Barbara Jusett. To listen to this show and all other archive programs with Mind's Eye Radio, go to radioforall.net. That's four, like the number four. This is Greg Willard. Till we reunite again, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio. And you really think I haven't changed that much?